The show you have selected will start directly after the next message.
Can you help me, please? I've had a problem with my health for years and I can't get to the bottom of it. The doctors have run out of ideas.
I'd love to help. My name is Kevin Davis. Our bioresonance system starts with an automated full body scan. It's simply the quickest way to shine a light on what's going on inside, with treatments during the same session.
Right, can you book me in, please?
For the latest health tech at the best price, visit biohealthtech.co.uk today and make us your first choice for a healthier you.
If only I'd found out about you sooner, it would have made so much difference.
Hello and welcome to the very last Yes to Life show of 2018. I'm Robin Daly, founder of the UK charity Yes to Life, and throughout the year I've introduced pioneers from around the world who've been pushing the boundaries of integrative medicine for cancer. I've been privileged to speak to many of my health heroes, people who have inspired me personally in developing Yes to Life. In fact, I started off the year speaking to one of these, Petrea King in Australia. The legacy of her work over decades is enormous, and she's undoubtedly changed the very way that treatment for cancer and other chronic diseases is viewed.
My question to people has always been, what is it that stands in the way of you being at peace? And sometimes it was nausea or pain or sleeplessness or diarrhea, or so we fix whatever the problem was with dietary changes or the addition of supplements or things like slippery on powder, which is a wonderful substance. So we'd address whatever the symptom was, and then those conversations got ever deeper into the existential questions of who are you? What are you doing on the planet? Are you living the life you came here to live? If not, why not? And what are you going to do about it? And of course, I found those conversations deeply enriching both for the person and for myself. And now some 120,000 conversations later, I haven't lost my passion and my joy in really seeing people recognise that they do have choices and that they can make a significant contribution to their own physical, mental, emotional and spiritual health and well-being.
Wow. Well, I can hear that passion, and so much in what you've just said. I just want to go back to when you were talking about your time in the cave there. You talked about your life grinding to a halt, and that was something that most people would see as a sort of negative, but actually you were talking about it there in a kind of positive way, in that the momentum of your past life kind of burnt out, and you were able to maybe see in a way you weren't able to before.
Yes, and of course, no doubt, as you found, Robin, so often people have been through some major trauma in the 18 months to 2 years, 3 years before a diagnosis of illness, of serious illness, and that's not just cancer, it can be other illnesses too, of course. But I think, you know, when your immune system's a bit depleted because of grief or because of pregnancy for some people and because of other things that have put a bit of a strain on your physicality, your vitality, those are the very times when it seems that we are more susceptible to developing illnesses. And that's why I think to only treat the disease and not to take into account the person in a very whole person way is to only do the minimum amount for healing, because healing is really about peace. Curing is about the body. And I've known many people who were cured of their disease, but they're still very much in need of healing. And I've known other people who died of their disease, but they were healed of every fear and every anxiety before they died. So to me, you know, I would never say to someone, you know, you must drink your juice and eat a fabulous organic diet and meditate and forgive everyone so that you don't die. By all means, drink your juice, eat a fabulous organic diet, meditate, forgive everyone so you live today well. And then, of course, your focus is on how do I live today well rather than how do I prevent myself from dying.
Yeah, very different focus. Interesting.
Yes, they are.
Yeah, and something else you mentioned was this transition between the way you had been living and living with uncertainty, which seems to me such a big point. You describe it almost as like a completely foreign land, a completely different way of being. But, of course, it's in line with the reality, you know, the certainty we all tend to live with. Generally, we've made it up anyway.
That's exactly right.
Another of my personal health heroes has singled out care and compassion, or should I say lack of care and compassion, in healthcare internationally as the focus for his energies. Dr. Robin Youngson is also based on the far side of the planet in New Zealand, and unusually, he's come to this mission from within the healthcare system. The times when we're very ill or injured, they're some of the most vulnerable times in our lives and times when we're actually most in need of care. So you've dedicated, you know, more than a decade to the effort to bring compassion into healthcare. I presume the issue must have been blindingly obvious to many, but thought to be some sort of unattainable goal. So what prompted you to attempt this Herculean task?
I remember the day when I decided I no longer had a choice about that. That's what I call my radicalization. That was the beginning of the Holy Crusade. It actually goes back several decades before that, because you mentioned the kind of the very stiff upper lip. I grew up in the UK. My dad was a doctor, so I was interested in medicine and caring. But I spent, because he was in the army, he spent a great deal of his career in overseas hospitals. And as a consequence, I spent some years in a boarding school in England. And I think the English boarding school really is the archetypal model for the hospital culture.
Right.
Because if you think about small children, I was 10 when I went to boarding school, you're sent to this dreadful place. You're forcibly separated from your loved ones. You lose your identity. I was never called by my first name, only my second name. You have to wear a uniform. You're subject to just completely arbitrary rules and this kind of rigid timetable. You're served the most awful institutional food. There's no privacy. You have shared dormitories, shared bathrooms, and it's lights out at 10 o'clock. And the person in charge, who's a fearsome character, is matron.
Right.
So my experience at English boarding school really made me empathize with the experience of patients within hospitals, and I knew suffering. So for my whole career, I'd been an advocate for patients, and I tried to support them. But in 2004, a teenage daughter, Chloe, she was 18 at the time, had a major car accident and broke her neck and her back, and ended up in our biggest trauma hospital in New Zealand, where she had superb clinical care. There's no complaints about that. But she ended up in hospital for 3 months with a broken neck and a broken back, being conservatively managed in spinal traction. So she was tied down to a bed for 3 months with her head completely immobilized. And although her clinical care was really good and she was under the care of a surgeon I knew well, I had anaesthetized for many times in my role as an anaesthetic consultant. It was the complete neglect of her really basic human needs. So she's lying in a bed, she can only see the ceiling, she can't read a book or a magazine, she can't see a television, she can't look out the window, she can't even see the faces of people who come in the room. And our assumption was in this very big, flash, new, biggest hospital in New Zealand that they would quickly perform a disability assessment and figure out what disability and communication aid she needed to connect her back to the world. And that utterly failed. It simply did not happen. In the 3 months in hospital, she never had a disability assessment. The occupational therapist never came to visit her, even though they agreed that was their job. Right. Such was the pressure on their service and priorities, it never happened. And another thing that you need to survive and to recover from injuries, apart from psychological well-being, is really tasty, nutritious food. And hospitals are incapable of providing that. Mm. We have a great system to bring meal trays to a room and an hour later take it out again. This food is, she's a vegetarian, so the food is very unappetizing. It has almost no nutritional value. It's out of sight. It's out of reach. She can't feed herself. Many days she actually went hungry.
Right.
In our biggest hospital. So Meredith, my wife, set up a kitchen in her room and for 100 days cooked tasty, nutritious food for her twice a day to make sure that, you know, A, that she had something to look forward to and enjoy, and B, that she had the nutrition she needed to recover from injuries. That cost us more than $1,000 in hospital car parking, even though the hospital care was free. So she did make a great recovery from her injuries physically, and she walked unaided out of the hospital after 3 months. Mm. And we're really grateful for that. But if we had not intervened to support, you know, I installed a laptop computer, which I mounted on the bed frame, and Meredith was there to provide her with the food she needed. And with that support, she made a great recovery. At the time, I was a powerful person in healthcare. I had been a senior specialist anaesthetist in that very hospital. Mm. I had been the corporate advisor for quality and safety in that hospital on the executive team. At the time, I was a member of a national committee advising the New Zealand government on quality and safety in healthcare. And yet with all that power and authority, I simply couldn't get the hospital to respond at all to the basic human needs, beyond the clinical care of a pathology. So that was the experience that radicalized me.
Yeah, right.
And gave me a commitment to try to do something about it.
Sarah Davenport is another person I knew of long before getting the opportunity to speak to her directly. Her work in establishing Breast Cancer Haven as a leading charity providing support to those with breast cancer is legendary. This year, she wrote her first book called Reboot Your Health, in which she's channeled her passion for health and for making personal healthcare much more accessible. I haven't had sight of your book Reboot Your Health for long enough to read it from cover to cover before the interview, but I have had a power read and I've got a pretty fair idea what's in there. I'm going to place your new book under the heading of prevention, as it seems to me it's aimed at people who are still up and running, although not really all that well. So it would seem to be a handbook for avoiding chronic diseases such as cancer. Would you say that was a fair description?
Yeah, I would. So now I'm really on a mission to get people to get back in touch with their bodies, because, if you sort health problems early on, you can absolutely stop them from turning into something more horrible. Mm. And one of the things, the two reasons why I wrote it, actually, because I haven't written a book before. And the first was, obviously, at The Haven, I talked to hundreds and hundreds of people over the last 20 years, and one of the things that struck me most was the grief and the deep regret that so many of them had, that they hadn't listened to their bodies. Mm. They hadn't heard them going wrong, because if you pay attention when you get you always get a little niggle. Your body will always tell you that it's, things are not as normal. Yes. But the problem is nowadays we're all running so fast and our lives are so busy and we're rushing from one place to another that I think we rarely take the time to sit still and listen. And that's why, you suddenly find yourself on your doctor's doorstep with a serious health condition.
Yes.
Whereas actually, had you caught it earlier on, you might have avoided that situation. And the statistics are really quite frightening, because I think in the UK, if you're 65 years old, 80% of 65-year-olds have one chronic condition, and 68% of them have two. And, more and more, the older you get, the more you have.
Yes.
So actually, I just think people presume it'll be all right, that they'll get to be 95 and they'll all be fine, and all the people who are sick are somebody else, not them.
Yeah.
But I just think people need to be aware. I think everyone's forgotten, because it's a bit like cooking, actually, I think. Everyone's forgotten. Everyone used to be able to cook, and everyone used to be able, they knew all the basics of health.
Yes.
But, along have come supermarkets with their ready meals, and everyone would much rather just grab one from the supermarket than have to do the shopping, cook it, prepare it, clean up afterwards. And it's the same with health. We've given up that responsibility, I think, and now everyone just goes, oh, go to the doctor. Mm. And as we know, the doctors are struggling under that burden.
A subject we've focused on extensively in the last year is medical cannabis. It's the hot topic at the moment, and the high levels of interest are shared by both the research world and the public. Saoirse O'Sullivan is a researcher who's dedicated many years to the subject and so can speak authoritatively about what is and what isn't understood about cannabis.
There's a huge interest in cannabis amongst people with cancer generally, so I'd like to start off by asking you where you think things are generally as regards the evidence.
So the evidence for cannabis being useful in cancer?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Well, I think you need to kind of divide that really into two areas. The evidence that cannabis is useful for symptom relief, and then that cannabis might actually have some anti-cancer effects. So if I talk first about the evidence for symptom relief is really quite good, because there's a lot of clinical studies that have been conducted looking at this. So the kind of symptom relief I'm talking about is reducing nausea that's associated with chemotherapy, stimulating appetite and helping people to be able to eat, and also other kind of related effects, like just people generally feeling better, having a better quality of life, having a better mental health. So people report that they feel less depressed, less anxious, less stressed when they're using cannabis. And also people say that they sleep better. Mm-hmm. And then the other main kind of symptom relief area is also in pain. So a lot of people use cannabis for the pain associated with cancer. Mm-hmm. And in those areas, we do have quite good evidence because people have been doing trials for about 20 years mm-hmm. in this area. So we have quite good evidence that there is a statistically significant improvement in these symptoms when you're using cannabis.
Right. Okay, well, that's great. So how about actually as an anti-cancer agent then?
So this is where it gets a lot grayer, because it's really an area that is more evolving and a newer area, which means that we're at the earlier stages of the research. So kind of to provide the evidence. Mm. So from laboratory studies and animal studies, so this is where people are looking at the effects of these cannabinoid compounds on either tumor cell lines or in tumor models that they generate usually in a mouse. These studies have shown quite well that most cannabinoid compounds, including those that come from the cannabis plant, so the main ones being cannabidiol and THC. So in these animal and cell studies, it's been really quite well shown that THC and CBD can kill cancer cells and have lots of positive effects, like reducing new blood vessel growth and causing the cell to die, but also stopping them from multiplying. But that's in a laboratory, and often what we don't know is whether or not that translates into patients, because there is a big, big difference between doing these studies in a laboratory and actually doing them in a patient population.
Yes.
So the evidence in humans is not as good, and there aren't as many controlled studies. And I think it's really important to emphasize that. So there's lots of people who will... there's lots of people on the internet and people, you know, individual stories where people have had really good success with whatever compound they're using. But in order to be able to prove it from a scientific point of view, you need to do a controlled study where some people haven't used cannabis. And that's what we don't have any of these kind of controlled studies to be able to make that statement about whether or not there is an anti-cancer or anti-tumoral effect of cannabinoids. There is just one study that has been reported so far. So there is one placebo-controlled trial. So this is the kind of gold standard for medical research. There is one randomized controlled trial that's been done looking at a compound or a drug called Sativex, which is actually licensed for patients who have multiple sclerosis.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it is a combination of THC and CBD in equal quantities. So it's made by a UK-based company. And when you have THC and CBD together in this one-to-one ratio, it's quite effective in MS patients for reducing muscle tremors. But this company, GW Pharmaceuticals, have done a trial in cancer patients. So these were people with brain tumors. And so it's the only controlled trial that's been done so far. They haven't published the data yet, but they have released a press release that said that the patients who took Sativex had a significantly longer survival rate than those who didn't, those who took the placebo. Mm. So that was reported last year. So we haven't had any more details on that study, but that study would tend to give us a positive indication that there is some kind of potential anti-cancer effect of these compounds, not just symptom relief.
Lillian Klein was a new name for me this year. Lillian is part of a growing army of nutritional therapists who are well equipped to support people with cancer and very passionate about doing so. My first question highlighted the challenges that go with the territory of supporting people with cancer. So apart from the attitude of conventional doctors, what do you find are the main issues you face going into this arena?
Well, I mean, I can think of the one that springs to my head as you ask that question is something, because it's something that's happened to me in the last 2 days, is I got sent an email to a cancer society, and I clicked on it to read the email, and whilst I was there, I saw that they had a whole lot of diet information and what to eat, and there was a snack information, and I clicked on the snack information. There were a couple of healthy snacks, but most of the food was things like eat cakes and biscuits and jelly and custard, sports drinks and muffins and this kind of food. Mm. And you know, these cancer societies are respected. People go to them for information, and this is very frustrating and negligent, because this kind of information doesn't improve people's health. I mean, there's so many other ways that you can maintain energy levels without eating processed foods that are devoid of any nutrients.
Mm,
we're in an environment where nutrition advice is confusing for people who don't have a chronic disease. So you add a chronic disease in, and then everyone's telling you what you shouldn't be able to eat. You look to a society or hospital or doctor for advice, and then you get information like that, which is very challenging. And I mean, I'm constantly told from my clients that they've been offered biscuits and sweets and that thing when they're having their treatments.
Mm.
And that is the concern. You know, I mean, I had a client recently who had mouth cancer, and obviously he was struggling to eat, and he was told to drink custard and drink milkshakes to sustain his energy. And so you're up against those, and that's the thing that angers me the most, is that the information that's been given out to people who are looking to help themselves is wrong.
Mm. So you're saying that it is not based in good science, and this is very frustrating. You have any pet theories about why such societies and doctors and people would be giving out advice that's so unscientific?
I think it's old. I think the information is old information. It's about calories. It's not about the actual nutrition. And we all know that there's a big difference between eating 1,500 calories of sugar and eating 1,500 calories of vegetables. You know, it's different. And that's been forgotten about. Well, it isn't to us, and it isn't to a lot of people now, but it's kind of information that I expect from sort of my mother's generation. You know, I remember growing up, that was the kind of information. You know, if energies are down, then have some sugar or put some extra sugar in your tea or have a biscuit and that kind of thing.
Yes.
But that's old. The research has gone way beyond that now. So that's why I think it's negligent, because there is science there to prove that this is the wrong information to be giving people, but yet it's still out there and it's still being given to people.
Mm. And what makes it hang around so long? Why on earth wouldn't the people, a society that's supposed to have the interests of people with cancer at heart,
Why wouldn't they want the latest information?
Well, I'll use an example. I mean, nutritional therapy has been banging on about vitamin D probably for about 20 years.
Yeah, more.
But it isn't till, it isn't until, you know, in the last sort of, I don't know, 5 years or whatever, the doctors started to actually check vitamin D levels and link the, you know, people's low energy or their immune system not functioning properly with a lack of a particular nutrient. We've been saying this for a long time. I think that the research takes a long time to filter upwards. So, you know, it might take, someone quoted me 10 years the other day, they said from a piece of research being disproved or proved before it filters out into the NHS, it could take around 10 years. So potentially that would be a reason.
Yeah, but, you know, given that kind of rate of change, if you put that against the rate of which the cancer statistics are getting worse, for example, or diabetes or anything else, we're doomed unless people start moving a bit quicker, really, aren't we?
Absolutely.
Sheila Dillon is one of those ultra-familiar voices of BBC Radio. She's the long-term presenter of the food programme and has achieved hero status in my book for tackling thorny issues relating to food and health at a time when no one else was. I was absolutely delighted to have the opportunity to have her as my guest on the YesLife show earlier this year. Talking about sugar here, and you clearly had the establishment in the crosshairs in 2013 because you made two programmes that year which kind of hit out at these kind of issues, and you made a programme all about sugar and refined carbs and its effects on health. So many people would say the official advice is unscientific, it's massively destructive of public health, and it's just plain out of date. But probably the place where this issue about sugar has got the most polarised is in cancer. You know, it's still out there in CRUK's top 10 myths about cancer that sugar's got anything to do with it, despite the fact there's good evidence now to show that it not only promotes cancer, but it can even cause cancer. Well, as you point out, the patients in the top cancer hospitals, they're being actively encouraged to eat the sugary junk food to keep their weight on. So the cautionary principle is being completely tossed to the wind in all of this, given the evidence, the fact that they're taking absolutely no notice, you know, the fact that science is moving in a different direction, is putting a huge number of people's lives at stake. I suppose the question is, well, are we just going to have to wait for those people to die off? How's this going to move?
How is this quote, scientific, quote, attitude to sugar going to change, you mean?
Yes. I mean, you know, it has had an impact in other areas. You know, Robert Lustig's work and Asim Malhotra, they have made an impression, definitely, and they're being heard, I think. But in the world of cancer, it's still on fighting to the death to say, no, sugar and cancer, there's no problem.
Well, it's part of the same ignorance thing, isn't it? I mean, it's, you know, what we talked about before, you know, this learned attitude that nothing counts but the drugs.
Yeah.
And they don't know anything. I mean, most doctors, when you talk to them, I mean, know absolutely nothing about diet. And what research there is about nutrition. I mean, they say all these things about sugar, but they're mostly parroting what you just said, you know, that this is one of the myths.
Yes.
I mean, it struck me very early when I was having my, you know, PET scan,
yes,
you know, which is the scan you ingest, you are given an injection of irradiated glucose, which then you sit and wait for an hour or so, and this glucose will show you where all the cancers are. And I thought, so you're telling me that sugar has nothing to do with cancer, and I could go on eating sugar, lots and lots of it every day, but you're actually using glucose to illuminate, because the cancer cells are all, you know, they're all feeding on this glucose that's just been injected into me, and you can see it because it's irradiated. And I thought, well, that's peculiar. But there is, I feel like, sorry, step back a few points.
Okay.
I've just been reading Michael Pollan's book, and he says one of the things we can agree on, in defense of food is what it's called, he said all sides, you know, are disputing the role of food in health, is that before the Western diet took hold, we were all much healthier. I mean, we had infectious diseases, but, you know, that were not the problems with obesity and diabetes and so on.
Right.
Well, we've now got to the point where apparently we can't all agree on that because, you know, there are these trolls and people who think they own the science on social media and people in the, you know, various medical establishments who think you have to have some sort of, you have to have a double blind study, large scale, to prove that sugar it has any deleterious effect on our general diets or any effect on cancer. And I mean, it's such an ignorant position. A, you couldn't do that on a, it would be almost impossible to do that kind of study.
Mm-hmm.
And so by talking about that, the need of these huge double-blind studies, you're basically cutting off any possibilities of progress in understanding. Because, and you know, and A, who would pay for that? Who would pay for such a study, even if it could be done?
Right.
There's no profit at the end. There's nothing you can patent. I mean, you mentioned at the beginning, you know, what's patentable? And what's patentable is that at the heart of so much of what's gone wrong with the research into cancer and other diseases.
Yes.
If it's not patentable, you don't do it.
Right. The metabolic foundations of cancer, in which, of course, sugar plays a huge part, was the subject of several of my shows throughout the year. I was lucky enough to catch one of the giants of 21st century cancer medicine when he came to London to speak at a conference. Professor Tom Seyfried is the author of a groundbreaking book called Cancer as a Metabolic Disease that provided the subject and focus for our 2016 annual conference. With his book, Professor Seyfried laid the foundations of a rekindling of interest and effort around the metabolic theory of cancer that I believe will, in years to come, be seen as a turning point in the treatment of cancer.
I wanted to talk to you about those experiments, but it's like, it's a, they're monumental, aren't they, these ones where they actually took the healthy nucleus and put it into a cancerous cytoplasm and it becomes a cancer cell.
And vice versa.
Yeah. So that's the really exciting one, is that you take a cancer nucleus and put it into the healthy cytoplasm, and it all behaves itself.
Yes, so, and the mutations are still there. You can still see the mutations there. They're no longer. Well, it's epigenetic. It's epigenetic. What do you mean it's epigenetic? What is epigenetics? Well, it's when the cytoplasm. Then they give you this cock and bull story about what epigenetics is, right? Epigenetics is an extremely complicated phenomenon. But in fact, it is an epigenetic phenomenon because it's controlled by it's an extra nuclear epigenetic phenomenon.
Yes.
It's the mitochondria that dictates the differentiated state of the cell. So it's an extra nuclear epigenetic system. People all think epigenetics takes place methylation, phosphorylation, acetylation. That's all intranuclear epigenetics. But there's an extra cytoplasmic epigenetic system called the mitochondria. And it's the most powerful regulator of epigenetics in the cell. And people still ignore it.
Mm. So those experiments are telling us very big things about cancer, aren't they? That's the first thing, as you pointed out. They lay the blame squarely in the environment that the nucleus is in.
Yeah.
And they also show that this is something we can influence, that we have the power to change this with things that are actually everyday factors, it turns out, with what you call lifestyle medicine. It comes in the door at this point, doesn't it?
Yeah, well, I think, you know, lifestyle medicine, I think, is really good to prevent cancer. Like I said in my book on chapter 19, I believe, to prevent cancer, you have to keep your mitochondria healthy. And that's a lifestyle issue.
Right.
So you engage in risky lifestyle behaviors, you risk damaging the mitochondria in a population of your cells in some organ that could put you at risk for the development of a neoplastic behavior, neoplasia or cancer.
Mm.
Okay, those are preventative and they're lifestyle issues. Once you have the disease and it begins to spread through the body, right? A lifestyle change will be partially therapeutic, but it's not likely to resolve your cancer.
Agreed.
Okay, mm-hmm. So you need to have both the lifestyle change, and you need certain drugs and procedures that work together with that to now restore the normalcy of your organ and to selectively and slowly kill off the tumor cells. They will die. They will die, and they will not be able to recover if you do it the right way. It's a staged process. We call it press pulse, and we adapted that from the field of paleobiology.
Okay.
So that's a strategy where we put pressure on one fuel, glucose, which we can, easy, and then we target the glutamine, the other fuel. There's only two fuels that drive the beast, glucose and glutamine. Glucose is very easy to target because our bodies don't need glucose. Okay, glucose, we have ketone bodies that will replace glucose as a natural mm-hmm. fuel. We don't have as easy task to manage glutamine. You need drugs to do that. So it's a combination of pressing glucose down and elevating and sequentially pulsing to target the glutamine issue. So once we are able to do that, we can slowly degrade and not the cancer. And not only that, we improve all of the physiological parameters. If you have type 2 diabetes, that's also managed. It's unbelievable. If you have cardiovascular disease, that can improve significantly. So the same process to eliminate the cancer in your body is also recovering other malady, because many of these people who have cancer are suffering from all kinds of systemic inflammation.
Right.
They have all kinds of other issues.
Right.
They're metabolically a mess. But when you get rid of the cancer, you're also getting rid of their other problems. So they emerge from the therapy healthier than when they started. No hair loss, no vomiting, no nausea. Maybe a little bit at the beginning, only because of the dramatic change in diet. And that can cause some people to get a little queasy. But once you do it gradually, the problem we have right now is compliance, how you can keep people compliant with the metabolic therapy. And that's why the press pulse strategy is designed to complete the process within a 6 or 8 month period. So long-term compliance, rigid compliance, becomes unnecessary. So that's our strategy. We don't want people to be, oh, for the rest of my life, I can never have a chip
right.
or a crisp or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah.
You know, we don't want to convey that kind of a discomfort. We want to be able to take care of this cancer problem in a reasonable period of time, just like standards of care, but without toxicity, based on the fundamental knowledge of what the disease actually is.
Mm-hmm.
And that's totally different than what exists today.
Travis Christofferson was one of the speakers at our 2016 annual conference that I mentioned earlier. His part in the move towards looking at cancer as essentially a metabolic issue has been to write a book with a much broader appeal than Professor Seyfried's heavyweight science book. Tripping Over the Truth has been enormously important in bringing forward an understanding of the thinking behind metabolic theory and its relevance to treatment choices.
Okay, so you've mentioned metformin a few times. I want to talk a bit more about this kind of area. Yeah, I think as a result of you coming over to our conference, charging down the wrong path, and meeting one of the doctors from the Care Oncology, that you're now involved in this. And I'd like to hear a bit about, the metabolic thinking, if you like, behind this rather odd combination of drugs that people are being given to help with lots of late-stage cancers.
Yeah, I did. I met them at your conference, so thank you for that. That's one of the wonderful things about conferences is that those spin out. So CARE to me is one of the most wonderful organizations that I've ever seen. And just from a humanity perspective, you see these huge problems in oncology. And they're so clear. And they're solvable, but nobody does it. And CARE is the first one to just step up and do what needs to be done. There's this huge universe of drugs out there, about 2,000 drugs approved worldwide. Most of these are small molecules. On average, a small molecule will affect about 6 clinically relevant pathways in a cell, yet these drugs are indicated for 1 or 2 diseases.
Mm-hmm.
So what that means is there's all this unrealized potential in the our existing drug pool.
Right.
And we know that. And what happens is a drug like, for example, metformin will fall down to the generic status. When it does, and then you'll notice as it's prescribed over decades that it has, you know, fantastic potential for other diseases. And in metformin's case, it's cancer. And so we see it clearly. There's so many studies that demonstrate this capacity of the medication. But as a generic, there's nobody to take it through the trial to win a new indication, so it gets on the radar of oncologists to prescribe it in a clinical setting.
Yeah, just to be clear there, when you say a generic, what you mean is that it's out of patent and it's not making big bucks anymore like it was when it first came out.
Precisely, yeah. By generic, I mean off patent, and you know the price of metformin now has dropped to about $4.97 for a month's supply. It's dirt cheap.
Thank you.
And ironically, that's the problem. There's no way for anyone to make money, so they just sit there. So CARE was the first organization that I know of to try to do this, to bring these drugs out in the best possible way. And by that, the most promising ones in the most promising combination, because as you mentioned earlier, there's all kinds of synergies between drugs, and that's what we're after, is to capture the synergy between them. The safety, because these have been prescribed for so long, we know the safety profile. And then to get them into the clinic, and at the same time, you know, treat patients while measuring the effect of this combination through clinical trials. So it's an absolutely beautiful model to capture the potential of these drugs. I was delighted to try to help bring them to the United States. And that's what we've done. We've established a clinic here, and we're treating patients. So we want to just, you know, do exactly what they've done to the UK, that model here in the United States. Mm. And there's going to be a lot of traction and enthusiasm, you know, certainly from the patients who know what we're doing's perspective, but we're getting more and more doctors that are seeing what we're doing and, you know that it's the right thing and referring patients to us and so forth.
Mm. It's a different health environment, of course, in the States. And do you think this affects the way that some new initiative like this is seen?
Yeah, you know, I think we're a little more flexible than you guys over there in the UK. Because we are so sort of haphazardly organized with different payment systems, private insurance companies, you know, the government, Medicare, and so forth, and different sort of clinics that do different things. So it's a little more, I would say less restrictive here in the States. But, certainly what we're doing is new. It's not very common to do these sort of generics off-label. Using things off-label in oncology is very common. About 50 to 75% of the drugs prescribed in oncology are off-label.
Right.
But they usually have at least one indication in cancer. So, for example, say Keytruda, one of the immunological drugs, the checkpoint inhibitors, has an indication for prostate cancer. They might try it for brain cancer, so they consider that to be off-label.
Yeah.
But our drugs, you know, say metformin is a type 2 diabetes drug, and we're using it off-label in cancer, so it's a little different, but not uncommon, not unheard of. And the lens that we look at it through and the lens that the patients look at it through is this risk-reward. And you look at these, and there's very minimal risk. You know, these are not dangerous drugs. You do have to be careful, of course. But the risk is minimal, and the reward could be huge for them.
Yes.
So they do that math. It's just unfortunate that that math is not more broadly adopted by the oncology community, because this data is sitting there for everybody to see.
Right.
You just search through PubMed. You will see randomized controlled trials on statins, for example, for liver cancer. It shows a doubling in survival when you add a statin to standard of care.
Wow.
It goes from 9 months to 8 months. So, you know, it's right there for everyone to see. It just does not get, because of the way the system is set up financially, it just doesn't get incorporated or broadly adopted.
Also a speaker at our 2016 conference, the inspirational Jane McClelland has been a regular guest on the Yes to Life show. And 2018 saw the publication of her long-awaited book, How to Starve Cancer. In it, she draws together the understandings gained from her extraordinary 20-year journey, which has led her into the same territory as Professor Seyfried and Travis Christofferson.
Just about out of time, but I do want to loop back to the introduction where you have your 10 steps to starving cancer. And
yeah.
I just want to, can you just give us a quick hit on each of these? It's going to have to be really short, I'm afraid, but starting with number one, which says, join my revolution.
Yes, absolutely, join my revolution. So let's join my Facebook group and sign up to Jane McClelland Off-Label Drugs for Cancer, which is, I've got nearly 3,000 members now. And this is just an educational group to try and get people used to the idea of using these old drugs.
Number two, attend the care oncology clinic.
Yes, and this is the clinic I discussed that is in Harley Street that I discovered in 2015 that is doing a very similar combination to certainly with the metformin and the statin and the other two drugs they use, and they're getting fantastic results. So I think it would be crazy not to go there and at least get on their program. They have great experience in individualising exactly what needs to be done for every patient, and they give very good follow-up. So I'm firmly in favour of people going there.
Saves them having to be quite such a pioneer as you, eh? You get some good medical advice. Yeah, okay.
They don't have to fight to get the drugs. They're there. Available, which is fantastic.
Really good.
Yeah.
Okay, number three, partner with a complementary or functional medicine practitioner.
Yes, integrative care is the key. And, I'm a firm believer that it's not just conventional, but, the complementary side as well as the off-label drugs, very important. Everybody seems to have an imbalance in their gut. Everybody has an imbalance of vitamins and minerals and, essential fatty acids, whatever it is, you need to have all these things individually assessed so that you can get yourself really back onto path to wellness.
Right. But also partner with a nutritionist, number four.
Yep. And it's getting the right diet, and hopefully people will be fighting. Hopefully, maybe one day my book will become a standard tome in some of these nutritional therapy courses. I'm hoping so. Certainly, I've got two of them interested already. It's about trying to make sure that people know how to personalise their diet. Mm. It is important to get it right.
Right. Number five, educate your oncologist.
Ha-ha, tricky one.
Educate your oncologist.
Well, and you can do that by, just getting on the course of the care oncology clinic and taking these off-label drugs. Hopefully they will see the results. And if not, you can wave my book under their nose and see how that goes.
Yeah.
And just try and discuss what you're doing. And hopefully they're not going to be complete blank forever, because the research on ketogenic diets and other diets and intermittent fasting, all of these different approaches are gaining momentum.
They can't close
off to it forever. They're going to have to listen at some point.
Number six, exercise.
And this is where people go, oh God, I can't do that. But actually, it's far easier than people think. It's all about timing. It's blunting that insulin spike that you get after a meal. So if you actually go for a walk about 15 minutes after you've had your food, you can just pull all the glucose out of your blood circulation and redirect it to your muscles, so that actually the cancer is starved. It's not getting the nutrients from your food in the way that it wants, and actually your body's grabbing it rather than the cancer. Mm. So it's actually far simpler. You just go for a 15, 20 minute brisk walk after your meal, and that does wonders.
Mm,
and not eating too late, and you can even eat exercise after an evening meal. If you can try and eat a little bit earlier, go for a nice romantic stroll with your husband or your wife in the evening, whatever. Just do something. And sit on that sofa and talk, which is the worst thing you can do.
Okay, number seven, monitor your blood glucose and blood markers.
Yes, well, I do recommend people get blood glucose monitors, because that's quite important, just to check, see how well you are metabolizing the food that you're eating.
Right.
So everybody's different. So, it's something I feel that people should do. I didn't do it, but, I would do now.
Right.
Yeah.
Number eight, sleep and de-stress.
Yes. cortisol actually is a big factor in driving cancer, but also it drives insulin as well, which is the most dangerous hormone in the body. Everybody thinks it's estrogen, it isn't. Insulin is the baddie. And it's just maintaining a sort of as low a level of insulin as you can get. And cortisol actually raises the level of insulin. And cortisol is just something, again, you need to keep under control. And it's linked to, but stress is linked to a great many cancers. And that's why.
Okay, number nine, keep hydrated.
Yeah, the concentration levels in your blood, it's not about, it's the pathogens actually seem to survive better, and you know most cancer patients do have pathogens in their blood, and it's just a matter of keeping everything hydrated so that you sort of improve the terrain around the cancer. You water it down, and pathogens seem to prefer slightly concentrated blood. They survive better, and this creates a toxic environment around the cancer cell. And this is not what you want. You want to sort of flush everything through. So keeping well hydrated is something that people don't recognise.
Okay, and last but probably certainly not least, number 10, don't give up.
Yeah, be like me.
Yeah, right. You're a good example.
Didn't give up.
Yeah.
Not a quitter. Absolutely never a quitter.
Yeah.
Even when I thought the chips really were down, I just refused to stop looking. Stop. You know, I never stopped learning. I never stopped searching for the answer and trying something different. So right. Absolutely. And so many patients are given these grim prognoses by their doctors and told that they've only got a few months to live or at most a couple of years. And they don't know. You know, how can they know that? They're giving the wrong combination of drugs. We know that. Boom. So if they actually change, if they actually were educated and started doing something entirely different, they would be quite pleasantly surprised, I feel. So, you know, with any luck, this kind of approach will be adopted, particularly as we are cash-strapped in the NHS, and the NHS should really adopt this because it's a cheap option as well as effective. And I feel we really could be saving so much money and really... The approach at the moment is so appalling, and people are just written off, and you should never, ever quit. Never, ever quit, I don't think. You know, never give up hope, certainly. You can accept that you have cancer, but you should never give up hope.
Well, there were many, many other extraordinary interviews I would have liked to have been able to include today, but sadly, that's all I have time for. You can find direct links to all the full interviews that you heard excerpts from today on the Yes to Life website. That's yestolife.org.uk. Click the show logo on the homepage. And you can also look through the complete back catalogue for 2018, and indeed a couple of years before, on the Yes to Life show page at UK Health Radio. Just scroll down to see and sample every show to date. Very many thanks for listening to the show this year. I hope it's been interesting and helpful to you, and that you'll be joining me again in the new year for more. Wishing you all the very best for the coming year. Bye.